Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson. Greetings and welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Tapson. Islam has been in the news almost nonstop lately, you may have noticed. From beheadings in Europe to the appeasement of Iran to congressional hearings about Sharia law to the election of a Muslim communist to New York City mayor to controversial attempts to establish Islamic communities in Texas, the so-called clash of civilizations is alive and well. Although I'm just going to say it, it's not a clash of civilizations so much as a clash of civilization and barbarism. This clash has been part of our national conversation beginning as far back as the 1979 Iranian Revolution, although that conversation didn't really heat up until the 9/11 attacks nearly 25 years ago. And yet in all that time, and even up to today, we in the West understand precious little about Islam. Certainly many of us have educated ourselves about it, but thanks to the pervasive influence of multiculturalism, there is still not only a frustrating, widespread ignorance about Islam, but a willful blindness about it that hampers our ability in the West to come to terms with this supremacist ideology that is at the heart of that clash of civilizations I mentioned a moment ago. As you probably well know, there are many writers and thinkers past and present that you can go to enlighten yourself and others about Islam, but I can't think of anyone better qualified, more learned, more insightful, and with a clearer grasp of Islam than my guest in this episode, a man I'm proud to call a friend and colleague. He is an insanely prolific author with so many valuable, invaluable books on Islam that I hardly know where to begin, but I'll list just a few. The Truth About Muhammad, The History of Jihad, The Critical Quran, Religion of Peace, with a question mark, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Islam and the Crusades, Stealth Jihad, and a brand new one that manages somehow to be a unique take on Islam with insights I haven't read anywhere else. So stay tuned, you don't want to miss this conversation. And don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take if you don't already, so you don't miss any of the compelling conversations we are having here. Don't touch that dial. My guest today at the intersection of politics and culture is a true scholar and a gentleman. He's a Shulman Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center, the director of the essential website Jihad Watch, the author of nearly three dozen books ranging from political commentary to history to theology to biography, not to mention his prolific daily commentary at frontpagemag.com. His newest book is The Tragedy of Islam, Failure and Excuses, which I'm excited about getting into today. Robert Spencer, welcome back to the Right Take Podcast.
Great to talk to you again, Mark, as always.
Yeah, thanks for your time. I know you're a super busy guy, and I think you're even traveling at the moment, so thank you for coming on. There's so much to talk about in this book, so many different ways in which Islamic ideology fails to live up to its own supremacism. I hardly know where to begin with this book. I guess let me just start with asking you why and maybe how you settled on this theme to write about.
Yeah, you know, The Tragedy of Islam is a book that I've wanted to write for many years and never have had the opportunity to do so before. I think I even, if my memory serves me right, submitted it to a publisher about 10 to 15 years ago, and they didn't think that it was a good idea, but I didn't agree and kept it around and submitted it to my current publisher more recently, and was very happy that they accepted it. It's an idea that I think is completely original. It's not like any of my other books, and it's not like any other book that I know of. It is an exploration of a very simple question that I don't think has been asked before, and that is, does Islam work? Is it actually good for individuals and societies? And this book demonstrates, I think, in a convincing fashion that it does not, actually. It's not good for individuals or societies. And that can be shown in the lives of converts to Islam on an individual basis and by an examination of the economic health and the human rights records of Islamic societies, both in history and today. and that in all of these different explorations, Islam comes up short.
This promise in the Quran that Allah will cause the righteous to succeed not only in paradise, but on earth as well, why has that not been kept for the Ummah, the worldwide community of Muslims?
Well, it's not been kept because there is no Allah, and so his promise is hollow because he's not there to fulfill it. But it is a fact indeed that the Quran promises that the believer, and this is unique among the religions of the world, that it promises that the believers will prosper in this world as well as the next. There is actually a strain of Christian theology, of Protestant Christianity, called the prosperity doctrine, which is just as ridiculous, as a matter of fact. And Islam, it's much more, in Islam, it's much more mainstream. It is said in several times in the Quran, both in positive and negative ways. That is, the Quran says both that the believers will succeed in this world as well as the next, but also that those who have incurred the wrath of Allah will feel that wrath in this world as well as the next. And so we should expect, if Islam were true, that the believers, the Muslims, would be among the most rich and powerful people in the world. That the Muslim countries would be the powers of the world. And instead, we find just the opposite. If it weren't for the geological accident of striking oil, Islamic societies would be actually among the poorest in the world. Yes. Those that don't have oil, they are among the poorest in the world. And this can be directly traced to a very simple fact, as I show in the book. The Quran teaches not a work ethic, not the blessedness of work, which is something that we find in Christianity, the idea that God will bless the work of your hands if you are righteous and you try to serve him, that you will be blessed, not necessarily always with worldly success, but you will nonetheless be blessed. Instead, you get the idea that work is somehow kind of shameful, and that it's really something that non-Muslims should do, that the Quran teaches that non-Muslims should pay for the upkeep of Muslims. That's what the jizya tax is all about, that's specified in the Quran. And consequently, if you are a Muslim, you should not be thinking, I should work and Allah will bless my work, but you should be thinking that the non-Muslims should be paying my bills here. And if they're not, then you have a license to steal from them, because legitimately the money is yours. And so instead of a work ethic, it teaches actually a spirit of a kind of parasitism, that the Muslims should live off the non-Muslims. And when the Islamic societies of the past were great, that's exactly what they were doing. The non-Muslims were paying all the bills through their jizya tax. But when the non-Muslims were bled dry and could no longer pay the tax at the rates that they had been doing, then the Muslim societies went into decline. And so it creates a parasitical culture that doesn't produce on its own. And when the non-Muslims can't sustain the Muslims in the manner in which they've become accustomed, then the societies start to their death spiral.
Yes, and of course, it's the Protestant work ethic that's largely responsible for building America, the freest, most prosperous country in history. Talk about the jizya tax a little bit. That's an important point that almost never gets discussed about Islam. What is the jizya exactly, and how does that work? How does it fit into Islamic ideology and their relationship with infidels?
Yeah, you know, Mark, this is very important, and a lot of people don't realize just how important it is. The chapter 9, verse 29 says that Muslims should fight against even the people of the book, which is the Quran's term primarily for Jews and Christians, as well as Zoroastrians and a few others. The people who have supposedly revealed revelations from Allah that predate the Quran. And they're not perfect like the Quran. And actually, the non-Muslims have actually dared to corrupt them. But because they have these revelations from Allah in the Quranic scheme of things, the choice is given to them that they can either convert to Islam or pay the jizya, which is the tax that chapter 9, verse 29 specifies, that they pay the jizya with willing submission and feel themselves subdued. And so the idea is that the ideal situation, the ideal Islamic society, is one in which the non-Muslims are sustaining the Muslims and paying the tax to allow them to live high on the hog, so to speak. Not that hogs have anything to do with this, of course. And so the Muslim societies that were great in the old days, like the Abbasid Caliphate, the Ottoman Caliphate, the Mughal Empire in India and others, they all lived on non-Muslims. They lived on non-Muslims paying the tax. It's not that the Muslims didn't work, but they worked only to the extent that they had to, or if they were too poor to live off the non-Muslims, you know, not in a position of power so that they could collect the tax and live off it. And so as soon as this is what happens in every society, including our own, when the taxpayers don't have the money to pay the tax at the rate that they did before, then the society goes into decline. It just doesn't have as much revenue. And so I track this in the book, that the Ottoman Empire, when the jizya was its principal source of income, was conquering left and right and was spreading into Eastern Europe, threatening Western Europe, and was the great power of the world. When, on the other hand, the Ottoman Empire could no longer collect the tax at the rate that it had, because the non-Muslims simply were not powerful enough. Remember that the verse in the Quran specifying the collection of the jizya says that the non-Muslims have to pay the jizya with willing submission and feel themselves subdued. And the jizya is just part of that effort to make them feel subdued. The other parts have to do with institutionalized discrimination that leaves them taking only the most menial jobs in society, which we still see in places like Pakistan, Egypt, and elsewhere. And so the tax base steadily diminishes, because you're subjugating and discriminating against the non-Muslims while you're taking the tax from them. And ultimately, the non-Muslims simply can't pay the tax at the rate they had paid it before, because they're bled dry. And that's when the jizya became no longer the Ottoman Empire's chief source of income, because the non-Muslims were indeed bled dry, then the Ottoman Empire went into decline. And this is really the secret of the power of the great empires of Islam. It's all based on the jizya, and there's no more jizya to collect, or it can't be collected at the same rate. That's it for the empires. And so that's why they have to conquer new lands in jihad in order to continue to live high. And that's why we see the effort to do that today in Europe and elsewhere.
Yeah, I thought that was a fascinating chapter in the book about the economic trajectory of Islamic empires like the Ottoman. That's not something I've read about in any other history, actually.
That's my own idea. It came to me while I was working on another book, The History of Jihad, that it was very clear to me as I wrote that, that these empires were depending upon the jizya, and that their decline was especially correlated to the decrease of the amount of jizya that could possibly be collected.
Yeah, Robert, let's have a little sidebar here for a moment about a topic that I think it's worth addressing, and you do this in the book. As you well know, it's almost impossible to talk about the problem of Islam without hitting this brick wall of the objection that to do so is simply bigotry against all Muslims. In the book, you criticize Western leaders and educators for robbing Americans, as you put it, of the ability to distinguish between belief systems and individuals. What does that resistance stem from, and what's the necessary work that we're failing to do when it comes to having that conversation?
You know, Mark, I think there's been a deliberate effort to conflate the two, that people who should know better and really do know better have spoken about criticism of Islam, and specifically opposition to jihad violence and Sharia oppression, as if it equates to hating Muslims, because they knew that Americans, being generally decent people, would reject the idea that we should hate any group of people in particular. I mean, obviously, that's the great trauma and the great lesson of American history, that we have overcome racial discrimination and ended the institutionalization of racial discrimination. And it's sort of the original sin of the American political sphere to indulge in that kind of discrimination between people. And so when it came to opposition to jihad violence and Sharia oppression of women and others, many people on the left began to speak as if this were just another kind of racial discrimination, and that the opposition to jihad was really just a way for the racial bigots and so on to reassert themselves. Now, this is ridiculous on many levels, most notably the fact that Islam is not a race. And there are Muslims who are white, there are Muslims who are of all races, and there are Islamic jihadis who are of all races. And so the idea that this is some kind of racial hatred is ridiculous to anybody who thinks about it for a minute. But a lot of people don't think nowadays, and the educational level is very low. And so this has been an idea that's been allowed to propagate and has been spread by the left in a tremendously irresponsible fashion. But it really is a very simple thing. There's the belief system on the one hand, and there is the individual believer on the other. Now, see, I'm a Christian, and so I do various things that show that I'm a Christian. You know, I go to church and support Christian causes and so on. But am I a perfect Christian who loves his enemies and turns the other cheek and does all the things that are known as the hard sayings of Jesus? No, absolutely not. I should, and I do sometimes, but like most of us, I fall short in many ways. Now, does that mean that Christianity does not actually teach those things? It does not. Christianity still teaches what it teaches, regardless of what I do or don't do. And it's the same thing with Islam. What Islam teaches is one thing, but what any individual Muslim does is another thing. People ought to be able to make this as a very simple distinction, but instead it's been ingrained in them by the left that if you criticize Islam, if you oppose jihad, that you must hate Muslims. And this is what we hear over and over again in an attempt to shut down any such criticism.
You have a very insightful chapter in the, well, they're all insightful chapters, actually, but you have one that I especially found interesting called Destroying the Beloved. What's the nature of the love-hate relationship that the Islamic world has with the West?
Well, see, when you have a parasitical society, as I explained, then it's going to kill the host. That's what parasitical societies do. And so when you're talking about Islam living off the jizya, bleeding the non-Muslims dry so that they can no longer pay the jizya at the same rate, that's killing off the host. That's the parasite killing off the host. And so the parasite, in a certain sense, depends upon the host, needs it, loves it, but at the same time does not love the host enough to allow it to live. And so it always ends up destroying the beloved, destroying the host. And then what happens? Well, that's what I mentioned before in passing, that the jihad has to be waged against a new group of non-Muslims who will then become the new host. And so the whole thing will keep on and replicate itself. And now we see Muslims streaming into Europe and boasting about how they'll soon take over. And that's just another instance of the parasite finding a new host. And as a matter of fact, you find Muslims boasting about going on welfare and about not going into Europe to work, but going on welfare because that is the quintessential payment of the jizya in the modern age, where it's not formally paid, but it is de facto paid by the non-Muslims in the form of welfare payments to the Muslims, who are perfectly able-bodied and could work, but they know that it's the infidels' responsibility to support them. And so they're content to live off the welfare of the non-Muslims as a kind of substitute jizya payment.
Speaking of jihad, several chapters in your book discuss variations of how failure breeds jihad. What is the theological link between a society's perceived humiliation and waging war on those outside the Dar al-Islam, the world of Islam?
Well, see, like I said at the beginning, Islam doesn't work. And so when Islam doesn't work, what's a believer going to do? Well, one thing you can be pretty certain he's not going to do, except in very rare cases, is conclude that Islam doesn't work. In other words, he hears the call to prayer, which says, among other things, come to prayer, come to success. And he doesn't find success because the whole thing's a lie. But he's not going to say, oh, Allah's a liar. And I'm not succeeding because there is no Allah, or because this whole thing is fake. He's not going to say that. So what can he say? He can say, I must not be doing enough. And this is the temptation that all the believers always have. There's always more you can do. You know, if you're a believer, you could pray more. You can go to the mosque more. You could spend the night in the mosque praying. You can do all manner of things that are greater than what you're doing now. And maybe that'll help. Maybe that will bring you Allah's favor. And so the believer will very likely come upon a statement that Muhammad made, that one of the Muslims came up to Muhammad, according to Islamic tradition, and said to him, "What can you tell me a deed that's greater than jihad?" And Muhammad says, I do not find such a deed. And so there's nothing greater than jihad that you can do. So if you are not succeeding in life, if you are not getting what you want in life, then you must not be pleasing Allah enough. So the best way to please Allah, and you can be guaranteed of his pleasure and his favor, is going jihad. And so the failure of Islamic societies and the failure of individual Muslims to succeed breeds jihad, because it leads Muslims to think, I have to figure out a way to please Allah. I still haven't done it. And they decide to go jihad because no deed is greater than that. And that will bring them their great success.
And this sense of shame that they feel, this sense of having been humiliated, is especially acute when it comes to Jews and Israel, isn't it?
Yeah, because the Jews, according to the Quran, are the worst enemies of the Muslims. That's specified in chapter 5, verse 82, which says that the most vehement in hostility toward the believers, that is, toward the Muslims, will be the Jews and the polytheists. And so the Muslims have a special hatred toward Jews because of that passage and many others that specify that the Jews are really indeed the worst enemies of the Muslims. They're always scheming against them, scheming against Allah, trying to foil the plans of the Muslims. This is all through the Hadith literature, all through the Sirah literature, the life of Muhammad. And so if that's the case, then whose fault is it if you have tried to please Allah and you still end up not doing so? It must be the fault of the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And so you want to try to please Allah, then you can attack the Jews in particular, and that may bring you his favor if nothing else does. And so you end up undertaking various attacks on Jews to try to win over his favor by going against his greatest enemies.
Another objection that comes up all the time in terms of discussing Islam is the idea of a tolerant Islam, especially this mythical Andalusian paradise of medieval Muslim Spain, in which all faiths purportedly coexisted in harmony. What's the reality of tolerant Islam, and how is this idea often used as a social and even geopolitical weapon?
Well, it's a funny thing. It's a connection here, Mark, in the sense that here again, you have the failure of Islam and people trying to deal with it. Now, how do non-Muslims deal, especially in the modern world, with the failure of Islam? They make up an Islam that's great. Now, why do Westerners want to make up an Islam that's great? That is a question that I deal with in the book in various ways. Very briefly, it's simply because of the same kind of Western self-hatred and guilt that we see on the left so often, that anything non-Western, non-Christian is great, and anything that's Western and Christian is terrible. And this is, of course, due in great part to the Marxist influence in the West that is so prevalent nowadays. But it's also prevalent in terms of our dealings with Islam. And what we see are non-Muslims saying that Al-Andalus, Muslim Spain, was this wonderful place that was tolerant and peaceful. And this is designed in the first place for contemporary political reasons to make non-Muslims in Europe in particular more welcoming of mass Muslim migration. That instead of seeing the criminals and terrorists that the modern European states are bringing in, the attention is diverted or attempting to, the attempt is to divert attention to those who, to the wonderful mythical past, to the glorious 800-year-old Muslim Spain. And most Americans, of course, and Europeans have very little historical sense nowadays, so they buy it. They don't know any better. And secondarily, the idea is to take the edge off their own self-hatred and exalt the Muslims. There's not a whole lot to exalt nowadays, so they find this mythical past that they can exalt.
Let's zero in for a moment on a very significant influence in terms of your book's theme, and that is from the 20th century Muslim Brotherhood theorist Said Qutb, who offered Islam as the answer to what he perceived to be the failed ideas of capitalism and communism. Could you talk about his influence?
Yeah, you know, this is growing nowadays also. Qutb was put to death by the secular Egyptian government, or secular-ish Egyptian government, in 1966. But he's still quite influential. And as the Muslim presence grows in the West and becomes, and Muslims become more and more assertive and powerful in the West, we find this being repeated, that the West is very sick, which is certainly true, and is a desperately ill society. And then they say that Islam is the solution. And Qutb was one of the first in the modern age to posit this. And he actually said it very clearly, that communism was a failed society and capitalism was a failed society and Islam was now the solution for the Western world. And he said this in the 60s when nobody else was saying it, and it looked as if the idea of Islam being a formidable society and a force to be reckoned with was very much a thing of the past. But he saw it recurring, coming back, resurging, I should say. And he was definitely right about that, very clearly right about that. And so nowadays we see many Muslim spokesmen saying Islam is the solution for what ails the West. And they're following in the footsteps, and in many cases directly quoting Said Qutb.
Yeah, and you'd quote another Muslim leader along these lines who sees America as old and on its way into a nursing home. How should the West respond to, let's call it, the challenge of Islam to protect its own civilizational foundations?
Well, you know, for one thing, Mark, the West should respond to the challenge of Islam. Right now, the West is pretending there is no challenge of Islam. The West is assuming that Islam is wonderful and that it's completely benign and harmless and that there is no threat of Islam. And so they're welcoming millions and millions of Muslims into the West. without taking any pains, making any effort whatsoever to determine whether some of these people are Islamic jihadis. And not only are they not making any effort to determine if they're Islamic jihadis, they're also not making any effort to determine if they are Sharia adherent. Mm-hmm. And if they believe that the society that Sharia creates is superior to that of the West. And so the first thing the West could do and should do to deal with the challenge of Islam is recognize that there's a challenge of Islam. Right now, we have Chip Roy and a few others in Congress who have actually said, yeah, there is a civilizational challenge here of Islam. Sharia is an alternative societal system that would subjugate and destroy the free society we enjoy in the West, and we should be aware of that and fighting against it. And everywhere he's derided as a racist and as a bigot, just as I've been for all these decades now, and you've mm-hmm. been, and everybody who calls attention to this threat has been. And nobody seems to be willing to even examine the evidence. And really, it's not hard. You know, I testified before Congress in February, before Chip Roy's House subcommittee, and talked about the threat of Sharia. In response, the Democrats who were present, Raskin and Steve Cohen of Tennessee mm-hmm. and Mary Gay Scanlon of Pennsylvania, said Sharia is personal, private, religious law. It has yeah. nothing to do with non-Muslims. It's completely harmless. And anybody who thinks otherwise is a racist bigot, Islamophobe, and that was it. That was the extent of their analysis. Now, this is obviously false. All you have to do is look at Sharia in Saudi Arabia, in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, in Iran, and you see, oh, it's not private personal religious law. It's a law for the whole society. It denies basic rights to non-Muslims. It denies basic rights to women. So it is actually a threat. And all we have to do is open our eyes and look at those societies. But these Democrat lawmakers seem completely uninterested in doing that.
Is this Western passivity in the face of the threat of Islam, is this part of the reason that the goal of a global caliphate still seems like an achievable one for Muslims?
Yeah, you know, I would have said 20 years ago, I did say 20 years ago, that they're never going to establish a global caliphate. It's just a pipe dream. But they're going to certainly work to establish it, and a lot of people are going to get killed in the process, so we should be aware of these efforts. Nowadays, I think they've actually got a very good shot at establishing a global caliphate, not actually, of course, ruling the entire world, or even all the Muslims. But the West is so asleep on this issue, and is so close to being completely overwhelmed demographically by Muslims in Europe, that there could very easily be a European caliphate, and that would fire up jihadis all around the world to create a real religious war. They think they've got one on their hands now. It's nothing compared to what could come. But still, the vast majority of the authorities in the West have no idea of what's coming.
To get back to the theme of your book about the tragedy of Islam, the Islamic Republic of Iran has obviously been in the news a great deal lately in the last year. We've all seen how horribly the Iranian people have been abused and oppressed under this theocratic regime. How does the disenchantment, to put it mildly, of people living under the mullahs exemplify the thesis of your book?
Well, you know, they know, the people in Iran know, that Islam has failed. They know very well because they've been living under it for 47 years now. Yes. They have been living under a regime that applied Islamic law and that dealt with dissidents as if they were enemies of Allah. Because they figure, you know, the regime is implementing the law of Allah. So if you don't like the regime, you must not like God. And so they've been treating dissidents like that. That has led a lot of the people in Iran not only to reject the Islamic Republic, but to reject Islam itself. Because they see that it's failed. And so it's kind of paradoxical that in 50 years, I'm not going to say any closer because we've just had this crushing disappointment of the Islamic Republic looking as if it could be on its way out, and then it gets a new lease on life yet again.
Yes.
But in 50 years, I could predict the Islamic Republic will be no longer with us, and Iran will be a free society. but Europe will be full of Islamic states.
Hmm.
And so the free world will be what is the Islamic world today and vice versa.
And there's the tragedy of the West. Here's another of the many great points that you make in the book. You've already touched on this a little bit. I'm just going to quote you directly here. Islam is condemned forever to define itself only in terms of its relationships with competing faiths rather than on its own terms, unquote. You've already touched on this a little bit, but could you elaborate on that?
Yeah. If you read the Quran, I used to do this when I gave talks around the country. I'd always have a Quran with me. And somebody would inevitably, someone or some group would inevitably stand up and start saying I was a racist, bigoted Islamophobe. And they would say that, you know, Islam is peace and you're ignoring the peaceful aspects and this and that. And so one of the things that I would do was hold out the Quran that I had with me and say, open this Quran to any page you want, anyone at all. And you will see a furious denunciation of unbelievers. You cannot open the Quran to any page anywhere in the book without finding a furious denunciation of unbelievers. That in itself indicates the orientation of Islam, that it defines itself in terms of the unbelievers. And so the Muslims today and Islam today also defines itself solely in terms of how it compares to everything else. And that's one of the things that's behind all the claims nowadays that Islam is really the solution to the problems of the West. Islam doesn't even exist without the West. It has to have unbelievers, paradoxically enough, because it is this totalitarian maximalist imperative that the whole world's got to become Islamic. And the whole world, of course, never will become Islamic. And the Muslims should be grateful for that. Because if it did, they wouldn't really have any reason to exist. They're all about how they're better than everybody else. If you got nobody else, you're not better than anybody.
It's an absolutely fascinating book. And I can't say enough about it. Robert, you're so prolific that you certainly deserve a break. But I have to ask, are you working on something new now?
Yeah, I've just started a new book called Christian Persecution, A Global Survey. It's not really a very appealing title, and I might try to find another one, but that's actually what the book is going to be about, that it's going to go around the world and look at Christian persecution, not only Islamic, but Marxist as well, and explain why these groups have it in for the Christians and what can be done about it.
What about social media? What is the best way for people to keep up with what you are writing and thinking?
Yeah, I'm at JihadWatchRS on Twitter. A lot of restrictions there and everywhere else, but that's where you can find me. And also, if you're old-fashioned, go to the actual website, jihadwatch.org, and you'll see news about jihad activity in the U.S. and around the world.
Excellent. Listeners, I strongly urge you to get The Tragedy of Islam. It's quintessential Robert Spencer. It's scholarly but page-turning. It's provocative but grounded also in thoroughly documented evidence. Robert Spencer, thanks again for coming back to The Right Take.
Always a pleasure, Mark. Thank you.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in. Don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take if you haven't already. And if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. Be seeing you.